Okay, thank you very much. So after a bit of a couple of history talks, I'm going to bring us back to the present day, but it follows on quite well, I think, from this talk. Also be talking about problems of species definition and reproductive control. And I also think this sort of like wraps up quite nicely from the start of the day, because we started talking about this idea of like human control over animal sex in domesticated and farm animals specifically, and now I'm looking at this idea of like reproductive control over wild animals specifically in a conservation context. And obviously like agriculture is very explicit about the fact that it's controlling animals for human benefit, whereas conservation tends to frame itself as being in the interests of animals themselves, which is sometimes somewhat questionable. And I also want to sort of look a bit at how that attempt at control often fails and the issues around that. So I wanted to start off with this quote from a 2014 article in The Guardian by Kevin McKenna that pits these two species against each other, and the two species I'm going to talk about against each other in the zoo in the wild. He writes, "In a pathetic little enclosure in Edinburgh Zoo, visibly done up to resemble a scrap of rural China, the suffering of the giant pandas continues. The two are not even a third of the way through a multi-million pound 10-year stretch wrought solely for the twisted pleasure of gawping visitors stupid enough to swallow the fiction that they're somehow assisting in the conservation of these poor beasts and their kind." And then he goes on to say, "Perversely, 150 miles northwest of Edinburgh, one of Scotland's very few indigenous mammals and iconic of this country, struggles daily to retain a foothold in its very existence." And here he's talking about the Scottish wildcat. And he uses this comparison elsewhere as well. There's another article where he refers to the pandas as a grotesque Chinese circus act and the wildcat as Scotland's most vivid species. And I find this juxtaposition quite an interesting starting point for thinking about relations between bodies and species and spaces in times of mass extinction. These two species, pandas and wildcats, seem to be living these sort of dramatically different lives. You can see them as representatives of various dichotomies like freedom and captivity, nationhood and foreignness, distance and proximity, nature and culture in various ways. But there's one respect in which they are similar in conservationist terms, and that's the fact that they're both being threatened in part by their own sex lives. So pandas are refusing to have enough sex, and wildcats are having too much sex with the wrong kinds of cats. So today I want to explore how these sort of two poles of sexual threat, the impotence and the excess, shape the biopolitics of conservation and what it means to save a species. And biopolitics here, for anybody who's not familiar, just Foucault's idea of this, like making life itself the object of productive power, and it coming down to the questions of which bodies we're working to make live and which to let die. And I think this is really interesting to these species whose extinction has come to be sort of framed not as a problem of death so much as the problem of birth. And they're also both entangled in politics in a broader sense, and today I want to talk a bit about animal sex, two main aspects, as a mechanism of gendering in various ways and as a mode of nation making. And here in Scotland, where politics is very fixated on questions of like nationhood and sovereignty, I think that's it, there's like a lot of stuff going on around these animals, and I'm going to mainly be looking at some media texts that quite explicitly take these animal bodies as like a site for negotiating national power and identity. So first of all, I'm going to take you on a brief tour through the politics of panda conservation. Obviously one of the biggest sort of rock star faces of charismatic megafauna, and they're also one of the most overt examples of species conservation as like a mode of international relations, basically. This has been called panda diplomacy, where China sort of uses pandas as like gifts or loans to secure various kinds of like allegiances and trade links with other countries, especially since the Cold War. This has been like a big thing. And the Edinburgh pandas arrived in 2011 as part of a £2.6 billion trade deal, interestingly including a big deal on salmon exports, just to sort of link that. And as they've become like embedded in the Scottish public consciousness, they've taken on these various roles in relation to like the nation's political identity. So two framings here. On the one hand, the costly foreigners framing, which we saw sort of in that McKenna quote that I started with, this idea of these pandas taking funds and attention away from our native wild fauna. You can see that also in this Daily Mail headline, which talks about the pamper celebrities and the amount of money that's being spent on their bamboo and their accommodation and all this sort of thing. And then a different framing and a sort of similar analogy, this cartoon playing on the idea that like animal foreigners are sort of having an easier time crossing the British border than human ones often do. And then on the other hand, there's this idea of like the panda as a status symbol for a government that has an investment in projecting this image of like internationalism, economic competence, and the possibilities of independence at that point as well. And they became a figure, sort of a figure for the pro-independence movement in a different way. If anybody, anybody who was in Scotland between 2011 and 2016 will have become absolutely sick of this joke that there are more pandas in Scotland than Tory MPs, which was sort of used as this like catchy illustration of the idea of a democratic deficit, that we had a conservative government and had not voted for the Conservatives, we had more pandas than Tories. This is just a nice picture of a Scottish Tory hanging out with a panda. But the real challenge for making these pandas into like a Scottish success story brings us back to the problem of panda sex. So you might already know that these are animals notorious for being extremely difficult to breed in captivity, for a few different reasons. Most commonly cited being, well, females are only fertile for a very narrow window, for a couple of days each year, and even in that window, it can be really difficult to get them to breed. Both males and females often seem disinterested or even sort of incompetent at mating, and this has led to various kinds of erotic innovation. Apart from, obviously, artificial insemination, people have also tried things like panda pornography, and panda Viagra, and panda sex education, panda matchmakers, all of these sort of things. So obviously reproduction for captive pandas, heavily mediated, technologised affair. And some people also describe this as sort of a key part of the panda diplomacy thing. This is Catherine Buckingham saying, in many ways China is testing the global technological capacity through panda loans. The USA has proved its capability and technological prowess to China with the birth of its panda cub. Can Edinburgh do the same? And funnily enough, I found a comment on that Daily Mail story that I showed you earlier, which quite nicely tapped into the sort of geopolitics of this, by situating pandas in globalised commodity chains when they, this is just a comment that said, if they have a baby, I'll be so proud to see something stamped made in Scotland sent to China instead of vice versa. So, here we see pandas sort of shift from this idea of like the cash-draining migrants to lucrative commodities, and this breeding pair are like the sort of raw materials that are going to be transformed through human labour into a new and valued life. And Edinburgh has really taken up this challenge with some fervour. I talk about this as biopolitics in the sense that it's this sort of proliferation of like expertise and monitoring and recording and regulation aimed at panda bodies and populations that's working to incite and control what is supposed to be like this natural act of biological beings. And in 2015, The Guardian had this long piece on the problems of panda breeding, where the journalists went to Edinburgh specifically to document this really intense preparation that goes on in the run-up to ovulation. So these pandas are like constantly under the gaze of cameras. Every gesture that they make is like a potential sign of impending fertility. This is a sort of long quote about all of the sort of preparation that goes up to it. They're monitoring monitoring their consumption of bamboo, their behaviour, daily photographs of Tian Chan's vulva to ensure that everybody's ready for the moment that she becomes fertile, because it's not always obvious that it can sort of come on suddenly, basically. And the panda herself isn't always cooperative in this process. They also talk about wanting to analyse hormones in her urine on a regular basis. And although Tian Chan has been trained to urinate on command, she frequently refuses to comply. And the keepers have to go around with syringes to collect precious drops from the ground when she's not looking. And under these circumstances, it doesn't seem like that much of a mystery why captive pandas tend to be resistant to breeding. Like, I don't think a team of scientists watching you constantly, taking photos of your genitals, collecting your pee, does sound like a bit of a mood killer. But this reproductive failure has been a source of like intense consternation and like discourse, and in fact is often expressed as a very gendered inadequacy. So again, going back to that Daily Mail article that I showed you, that was written on the panda's arrival, and at that point it held them up as very successful emblems of their respective sexes. So the male was described as well endowed and boisterous, and the female was quiet and nervous, but both of them were congratulated for having proved their reproductive value because they both bred before with other pandas. But then a few years later, and after these sort of repeated sexual failures, the representations start to be inverted. So you see the male being framed in terms of a sort of feminized impotence. This is a quote from that article, where a zookeeper is saying, watching them sort of awkwardly attempting to mate, and says he's a gentleman and maybe he shouldn't be. And later she comments that the female is not seeing him as the big butch male. And at one point they attempt to address this problem by spraying the enclosure with a more virile male's urine in order to spice the air with competition and possibility, as the journalists put it. And on the other hand, the female is framed as this sort of stubborn, uncooperative, and incapable of doing her reproductive duty. And along similar lines, this is a quote from that panda matchmaker that I mentioned, who says of a different unresponsive female, if she's not going to breed, then she's genetically dead. Which is a very stark statement of this sort of conservationist biopolitics where individual lives are very explicitly subsumed to populations and species. And there's sort of gradually been some recognition that maybe panda agency might be important as a factor in panda sex, that maybe pandas want to choose who they have sex with. So a study on the importance of mate choice in reproduction was publicised under headlines like this: scientists find the secret to panda procreation, love. Which also ties back nicely to our first presentation there. And there's this sort of idea that, like, you know, you can't force love. So if panda sex is eluding us, it turns out it's only because they have this sort of pure aspirational model of wild romance that we can't replicate in the zoo. And in the end, in Edinburgh, Tian Chan has had multiple phantom pregnancies that had this sort of flurry of media attention and excitement that came to nothing. Which is quite common for bears. And just last month, the zoo has actually announced the suspension of the breeding program. They've given up the ghost on trying to get these pandas to breed, and the director of the program has resigned now. And I imagine that some people are going to be quite pleased to hear this. So there are obviously various issues with panda conservation is controversial in various ways for it, whether it's worthwhile, essentially. But also specifically in Scotland, whenever the panda pops up in the news, there tends to be at least one comment that's sort of beseeching us to turn our gaze away from this lethargic foreigner and pay more attention to our own vulnerable creatures. And this is where we're going to come back to the other charismatic mammal, the Scottish wildcat, which I realised I forgot to put a picture of a Scottish wildcat up, so I can't show you one, but they look quite similar to domestic cats, which is part of the issue. They're small wildcats. And estimates for how many are left in the wild dramatically vary for reasons that we'll see in a minute. But the more sort of dramatic numbers are as low as a couple of dozen left in the wild. And unlike the panda, the wildcat is having plenty of sex, but it's not the proper kind. So the major threat to its existence today is what's sometimes called genetic extinction. So there's this idea, it's interbreeding with feral domestic cats, and this is then said to dilute, sometimes even pollute, the genes of the pure wildcat. Obviously some unsettling racial undertones to all of this language that circulates around it. And the wildcat has been very much valued in this sort of sense of being an icon of Scottishness. And coming back to Kevin McKenna again with his very florid prose, because I think it's just a nice example of this. Such are the defining physical and instinctive attributes of this gorgeous and ferocious predator that it must have been made for Scotland just as surely as Scotland was made for it. So if the panda cub is this thing that's to be made in Scotland, is like a product for export and a symbol of our modern scientific expertise and industry, the wildcat is this, instead it's made for Scotland. It's this naturalising of the nation in like a fantasy of like continuity across deep time. And this is a similarly, along the same lines, a very dramatic passage from the homepage of a website called Save the Scottish Wildcat, who say, talk about far back in the history of Scotland, the earliest settlers told legends about wildcats so fiercely besieged human champions and worshipped them as forest spirits. Clans formed under the image of the wildcat and fought wars for the independence of the land. These are incredibly tough super predators capable of surviving Scotland's harshest winters, battling eagles, drawing the admiration of men who bested entire empires. Is all terribly cinematic and also very dramatically masculine as well. So we've got this idea, the wildcat is often defined in these sort of things by this idea of like it being a very elusive creature that's very averse to contact with humans. It won't come near you in the way that a feral cat will, is the idea. And this is sort of, it becomes a sort of representative of like an unbridgeable distance between like it and us, and this representative of irreducible wildness and so on. But now there's this idea that's been rendered vulnerable by getting too friendly with the cats who are too close to humans, who've been sort of tainted by this mark of domestication. And then the problem is that gradually it becomes difficult to tell which is which. And in another article, McKenna frames this wildcat's plight in this language of like fraud and deception, warning us of a counterfeit cat and a feline facsimile, and elsewhere he calls it a chimeric confection, a Frankenstein version of the real thing. So it talks about duplicitous hybrids that masquerade as pure bloods and gain access to legal protections as ornamental wildcats. So the idea that they're visually convincing but genetically inadequate. And all of this is part of a sort of, this is like a big tirade against Scottish Natural Heritage, the government agency, and their official conservation plan, which is sourced from a competing organisation called Wildcat Haven. Now, I don't have time to watch it. There's this sort of convoluted history of different conservation plans and organisations that have shifted over the years, but suffice to say that this animal has been dogged by years of very bitter conflicts about how best to go about conserving it. It gets quite acrimonious. And part of this comes down to disagreements about biopolitical strategy, whether to focus on captive breeding programmes to preserve the gene pool, or to focus on removing and neutering feral cats to keep this wildcat territory kind of free of temptations, basically. But it also comes down to a struggle over definitional authority and this question of when is a wildcat not a wildcat, this sort of ontological question of species, and the question of what the role is of wildcat agency in the project of protecting them from their own excessive sex lives, right? Because despite all that sort of virile, wild masculinity, the pure wildcat in the story that McKenna is telling there is sort of like, it's little more than a dupe. It's like being manipulated by the wiles of these feral and hybrid cats. And this is noted by one commenter on his piece. Sorry, I like bringing in internet comments sometimes. I think it gives you some idea of the discourse around this, where this person puts the blame back onto this masculine-coded wildcat, and they say it's not the primary problem that wildcats can't get enough of that sassy domestic pussy, which is really bringing up certain relations here. So all this talk of like masquerade and seduction and dangerous promiscuity, you can sort of see this other another gender story emerging, where the line between the wild and the domestic is also a sort of line between like a masculine authenticity and a feminine artifice. But these two are also sort of mutually contaminating, and they're haunted by these like border bodies of the feral cat and the hybrid cat. So the feral is like the domestic cat that's gone wild, is reverting to this sort of state of untamability and a sense of ecological homelessness. Like, it's not supposed to be there, it's not supposed to be in the wild, but it's also in the, it's a wildness without a proper place. And then the hybrid cat is even more disconcerting, because as soon as you start to look at closely at the boundaries of this species more closely, or subspecies, the Scottish wildcat being considered a subspecies of the wildcat species. But even looking at this, 2 minutes, thank you, they start to sort of disintegrate, and the ontology of the wildcat starts to come under threat a little bit, because domestic cats have been in Britain since at least Roman times. There's no way of identifying this original moment of hybridization, the sort of original sin. So that means that even our model of the pure wildcat can't really be conclusively identified as the same animal as the Scottish wildcat prehistory. And in this context, these problems of like taxonomic categorization and legal protection are just ever more complex, and this line between pure and impure ever more indeterminate. The questions of which animals should or shouldn't be having sex with each other becomes impossible to settle. And this anxiety about improper sex across species boundaries and about promiscuity and purity can obviously be read through these sort of national and racial anxieties. I think there's all sorts of interesting things to be said here about Scotland's specific sort of complicated relation to post-coloniality and race and whiteness and other things around Scottish identity in relation to questions of independence and sovereignty. Don't have time to go into any of those here, but maybe it's something to chat about. And just a final twist in the story is that the Scottishness of the Scottish wildcat also isn't as obvious as it seems at first. To start with, it also lived in Northern England and Wales as recently as the mid-19th century. And some conservationists frame it in those terms, saying we will judge our efforts to save the wildcat to have been successful when we can no longer call it the Scottish wildcat, because it's been restored to suitable habitats throughout the length and breadth of Britain. And on top of that, many biologists would now argue that the Scottish wildcat isn't a separate subspecies at all. It's just a population of the European wildcat, which is pretty much indistinguishable from. And in that context, the whole thing loses a bit of its gravity, because the European wildcat population is doing fine. So this is a story of a local rather than a planetary extinction, and this whole discourse of national crisis starts to look a little bit shakier. So am I done? If I could just add very quickly, the thing that I hope to have brought out there is not just this idea of like human control, but the way that animal agency sort of escapes and exceeds and complicates that excess of or that attempt at mastery over their sex lives. Yeah, that'll do.